Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And our icebreaker question was inspired by a Reddit thread. So the power was out, and because IT wasn't considered critical, they weren't on a generator. And so my question is, should IT be on a generator because it might help with recovery? And what would you do if you weren't on a generator? Because once you get that power back, they're going to expect IT to do everything and be on top of things.
Hey, this is Mike Thompson, and there's really a lot that can happen with a natural disaster. So first, I'm going to work out for myself, number one. And then if I'm safe, then I'll help the company. And when Hurricane Sandy hit, I had to go to one of my customers and climb up 30 stories in complete darkness because their building didn't have power, and relocate all their server equipment to another building. So that's what I do without power.
Hi, this is Kelly. And what I found kind of interesting was that they prioritized the services that IT run to keep online, but they didn't prioritize the IT division itself. I thought that was kind of an odd distinction. Obviously, the customer-facing apps and infrastructure have to continue running, but who do they think is going to help maintain it or make sure that it continues running and it's operating as expected, if not the IT people? Even with data centers kind of in different places, you'd think it would be important to have some type of backup plan for the actual physical folks who would maintain it, presumably during a disaster. Now, at least as far as I'm concerned, in my own house, at least, I have all of my stuff on battery backups. I'm everything that I need to keep running if the power would go out. But so far, I've been pretty lucky on that, so I haven't had to use it all that much.
I think that's an interesting point. This is Mike Buckby. Like, what would I do if the power's out? Play cards. But I think, like we mentioned, this is, I think, someone inspired by a Reddit post. There are a lot of like crazy situations that sysadmins found themselves in with all the natural disasters and a lot of the really unreasonable expectations that clients had with respect to maintaining systems. And they were evacuating, but they're like, you need to come to the office and take care of all this stuff. And like, no, we're evacuating too.
Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, if you enjoy our show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit Varonis.com/review. On today's show, we all know that all platforms and services we use, a lot of them collect data about us. And there was an article about how an individual requested data from Tinder because under the EU data protection law, you're allowed to do so. But the interesting comment about the article isn't about the invasion and God knows who knows about her deepest, darkest secrets, but the comment about how we can't feel our data. And we've heard of analogies of data equate to money, but I haven't heard of anyone talk about data as weight, and you can't feel like 50 gigs of photos, documents, and spreadsheets. And how would you play with this idea that we don't think about data as weighty things unless you're out of space? And how our mindset of how weightless data impacts how we think about data security?
I think what we're really talking about is like everything that's digital, you know, since we can't hold in our hands, I think we naturally as humans turn to, you know, analogies to try to better understand it, to, you know, understand the relation and the size of it. I think weight's an interesting one. What I would actually use is almost your field of view, that most of the time what we're doing is we're looking at just a very tiny sliver of data about ourselves, that we're looking at a single article on Facebook, that we're looking at a single match on Tinder or something. And we don't see the cumulative effect of all of that that's just being stacked up forever.
Or another way to look at it in the physical world too is, for those of you who use Google Maps or on your Google phone, if you have the option turned on for the history, you don't think about it on a day-to-day basis, like I'm going to run to the grocery store, I'm going to run to the post office, and the couple things that you do. But if you go back and look at your timeline on the maps from a day-to-day-to-day perspective, it really builds a pretty complete picture of what your life looks like in terms of where you go, potentially who you interact with, what businesses you frequent. So if you think about that and you look at the timeline, it really puts it in perspective just how much data is being captured. The particular moment you're running out to the grocery store is not memorable for any particular reason, I wouldn't imagine. But if you start to look at all of it cumulatively, Google, for example, would know that, for argument, you know, you go to the grocery store on Saturday at 10 a.m. every Saturday, more or less. So you establish a pattern behavior over time. And it only gets worse the more services you have, Facebook, Tinder, all those other things, with that data collected what you're doing where and when.
This is always the issue, is that there's all this data, but something people rave about with the Android and Google ecosystem is Google Now, which is the mobile assistant that is smart enough and learns from your behaviors to then help you out with things. That it knows, like, oh, pretty much every day you leave the office at such and such a time and go get the bus. So it automatically knows to, like, text you, like, oh, the bus is running late. It knows, oh, you're going to the grocery store on Saturday. Here's your list of stuff. That by knowing this information, it can do more to help you out. And so, you know, we're talking about this, you know, the data Tinder collects, saves, and uses. This is data that they're trying to use to find, you know, a match for you. And this is, like, maybe not so much with Tinder, but with a lot of these other dating services, in their ads, in their TV ads, they explicitly say this, like, hey, yeah, put in all your stuff. We'll use our scientific approach to match you with the right, you know, life partner for the rest of your life. And it sort of makes sense. Like, yeah, they're going to know a lot about you if they're going to do a good job of that.
It's not magic. They have to get that data from somewhere. So, and we're providing it. You know, I'm obviously very cognizant of these types of things, and I think all of us are, and I hope most people who are heavy internet users are aware of what's being collected. But even in the past couple of weeks, I've had a couple surprises, like the health app on my iPhone. I don't use a Fitbit or a fitness tracker or an Apple Watch or anything like that. I've never even opened that app, but I opened it recently, and without me knowing it, it's been tracking me all this time. I've literally never opened the app, and I open it up and I can see like my step count for however long I've had an iPhone, essentially. So all that stuff was going on in the background without me knowing it. And then today on Facebook, I had a memory from 12 years ago, and it was someone I don't even remember. I literally don't remember who this person is, but Facebook certainly remembers who they are. They probably know how I know them. I had some class with them in college or something, but you know, it's going to reach a certain point where in order to enable these amazing internet services, they're probably going to know more about you than you know about yourself. And we have to come with terms with that to a certain extent, but certainly it's something to be mindful of.
Kind of the other interesting thing too is as we start to link these apps together, like, you know, the services that have like the login with Facebook to streamline that process, the web just gets even deeper. I was having a conversation with an engineer that works at Spotify last weekend, I believe, and he was telling me how much of kind of a pain in the butt that is. He works on some of the recommendations algorithms for music, having to comply, for example, with GDPR because of the data they interact with and collect, it could put them into scope. So it's something to be mindful of. I mean, nobody thinks of your Spotify playlist, you know, radio settings or music preferences as something that would be in scope for GDPR, but just the data that they collect to build some of that recommendations could be considered personally identifiable information.
There's an interesting part of this. There's like that old joke about the camera, you know, adding 10 pounds to you if you're on TV. And that's, you know, because, you know, we look in the mirror, we're like, you know, sucking our gut and think, hey, I'm looking okay today. And in this article, they had almost the same thing where, you know, they say like, it knows the real inglorious version of me who copy pasted the same joke to match 567, 568 and 569. And a lot of the issue is this is our real selves being exposed, not the sort of mediated, filtered versions of ourselves. And that's, you know, shocking that that's beyond our control.
So since we're talking about our data and all the platforms and services, I just came back from Microsoft Ignite, and what I heard now is that a lot of people think that encrypting everything is the thing to do. And once you do that, you can drop the mic, go home, eat some tacos, and go to bed. And what is your take on encrypting all the data and what you need to look out for to decide if it's the path for you?
I mean, it should be the path for everyone. Unless you do nothing of importance online, you should be encrypting in some way. And, you know, I try to be mindful of this. I have my devices encrypted. I encrypt where I can, but I'm not encrypting my email. And I've certainly, I can guarantee you I've sent sensitive information through my email in the past, you know, year or so. And I, you know, they in this article, they mentioned like tools to encrypt what you're uploading to cloud services like Dropbox or Google Drive. And, you know, I don't even know what's in there. I have like a iCloud, I have Dropbox, I have Google Drive. I kind of don't know what's in what repository, and I've certainly never considered encryption. I hope I don't have anything sensitive in there, but, you know, I'm guilty of this, of not being mindful. But this is certainly something that everyone should take seriously, and hopefully tech companies will make this easier on people. I mean, like Apple, they do end-to-end encryption in iMessage, and devices are encrypted by default. So that's good. There's no barrier to entry there. It's just automatic, but that's not the same for every service or every company.
I think it's important to realize that, you know, encryption isn't magic. What it really helps with is a certain set of threats coming at you in a certain sort of way that you can imagine something like, well, we encrypt our data at rest. So our database is encrypted, everything is written into it. So you think, oh, this is great. And then someone uses, like we've talked before about a lot of issues with API keys and APIs. And so they're using a legitimate API to then access the data in the database, and they suck it all out from that. And it doesn't matter that it was encrypted at rest. So it's not a panacea. And I don't think it helps in a lot of cases, but it's, you know, defense in depth, and it's one really strict layer of defense. Certainly a good tool, certainly something that should be used more, but it's not magic.
Mike, you stole my word.
Magic?
Panacea. I was just about to say that, but you beat me to it.
You could use a word like panacotta or, you know, some other delicious word we'd slip in. Pancetta. So.
Ooh. Panache.
Panache. All these are good words. There's plenty of words left, Killian. I don't have
I'm done. All my words are taken.
And because I love to compare data to money, you know, and since cash is king, if hackers are able to get in cash remotely from an ATM, I just don't think that encrypting data is the solution. And there was a story where these hackers, they're able to go through multiple layers of security. The hackers use the bank's voice recording system to steal the domain admin's credentials, use those credentials to hack into the company's VPN, and was able to get inside. And they located the system to update the ATM software, used a fake updating package, and eventually they did some tests, and then they forced withdrawals of money. And if they can get money from an ATM remotely, they can get your data. Do things change when it comes to money?
I mean, companies care about it more. They're much more likely to be upset and respond to money being lost and data being lost, unfortunately. But I think this headline was slightly misleading when I started reading. I was like, oh, some sort of vulnerability around ATMs, network attacks. But really, it's a hacker getting full admin access on the back end of some bank's network. And of course, if you have that, you're going to be able to do all sorts of things. You can take data, you can take money, you can shuffle accounts. I think being able to get physical hard cash from an ATM is, you know, interesting and nice for criminals to have something that's maybe a little more untraceable. But I mean, if you have that back end access, there's a lot more you can do than just take money from an ATM.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm going to sound like a terrible person, but I much prefer attackers compromising those ATMs and spitting out money directly, because frankly, it's not my problem. As opposed to, you know, like the Equifax thing, where they've stolen everybody's entire life and they can ruin their life and do all sorts of horrible things. You know, for the most part, their response has been awful. And I know we're not really getting into it, but just the flagrant disregard for so much personal information is disgusting. But if the criminals are just out for a quick buck stealing money out of an ATM, again, that's not my problem. My life is not going to be ruined because of that. The bank's not going to be happy. But I'd much prefer criminals go after that avenue and get the money directly than, you know, destroy people's lives. I don't know. Good on them.
I think Killian's is part of Project Mayhem from Fight Club. That's what I'm hearing.
You've never seen me and Brad Pitt in the same place at the same time.
That's true. I have not.
You know, what's interesting to me about this is, well, one, did they actually catch these people? That was not clear at all from the article, but they seem to have a lot of information about them and like what their tactics were, that they're like, you know, chatting in probably like Signal or something, an encrypted, you know, chat app, and doing all this stuff and like how they pulled this off. So the two things that it made me think of is, you know, most companies outside of banks don't have ATMs or these sort of physical locations, but certainly, you know, have multiple sites, have multiple different, you know, physical entities where they're working out of. And that in a lot of ways, this is a typical sort of attack that, you know, there's escalation from, you know, a vulnerability up through the network, bypassing all sorts of restrictions. There's, you know, this way of exfiltrating. In this case, it was money, but, you know, it could have been data. It could have been, you know, something else. And just how sophisticated it is. And so all of those are very common threats in other areas that we've seen that with, you know, malware and ransomware attacks. We've seen those same, you know, traits and, you know, security threats in other areas. So I think it's easy to say like, oh yeah, this is a bank and doesn't, I don't have ATMs. I don't need to worry, but you do, like you were vulnerable in these same sorts of ways.
I mean, I think that's kind of exactly Cindy's point with this type of attack has weight. A bank can physically go and say like, this is $154 million. They have a physical presence for it. You know, they can picture a stack of money in their mind as opposed to 154 million records from people. It's not a tangible thing. They don't think about 154 million individual people. They don't consider data in that perspective, but it really is.
And to round out our discussion for today and to circle back to our initial icebreaker question about how IT isn't important enough to be on a generator when the power is out. And right before our show, I came across a tweet where someone said that InfoSec is seen as something for compliance reasons and not really for security. And I wonder, do you think that's why when people try to responsibly disclose a security vulnerability, they hit a brick wall? Because Troy Hunt just wrote an article about how hard it was when they got in touch with a company, but then they got blocked on Twitter.
Well, from the outside, I think people look at all of the InfoSec sysadmin stuff as a single monolithic block. And it's only when you're really, you know, inside of this that you see like, oh, well, there's different people with competing priorities. And, you know, a very common issue, like when you're talking about InfoSec and compliance, that you'll have someone who's like an InfoSec officer and they're at a company and they have checklists. And these checklists say exactly what they're supposed to do. And you know, their job is defined by making sure that every item on that checklist is checked. And sometimes it makes sense and sometimes it doesn't. And like the classic one is that like, oh, well, if we, you know, ping the ticketing system for IT, we find out, you know, the time that's on it because it's leaking, you know, the time information. But of course, you know, like there's a open web page that says like what hours are going to be responded to by the team. And so it doesn't really make sense that that's an issue. It doesn't really hurt that it's leaking this information if it's, you know, readily available elsewhere, but it's a huge issue to the InfoSec team. And so that kind of thing where it's more a bureaucratic checkmark than it is a real security issue is where I think the root of that is coming from. And I think that separate from that, you have issues where it's really hard to distinguish, you know, reporting from attacking. That if you're running, you know, in this case, Kids Pass, and someone comes up to you and says, oh, there's a horrible issue, it's hard to know the context of where that's coming from.
I think in a lot of cases, too, it has to do with ego as well. Nobody likes having their flaws pointed out. They're trying to deliver a service or do whatever, and nobody likes being kind of told that they've messed up. I think that's part of it. And to kind of elaborate on what Mike was saying about security versus compliance, in a lot of cases, I feel like they're very competing objectives. People tend to engineer towards compliance to check that box to make sure that they're not going to get fined, but that oftentimes has nothing to do with actually securing the data. Good example was I was having a conversation with a guy in compliance about some issues that we found. A ton of Social Security numbers and names we found doing a security assessment with them, and they were pretty cavalier about it. They didn't actually care because it didn't put them in breach of compliance because it was, you know, two of the three indicators they needed for like HIPAA, for example. It didn't have some other indicator in there. So they said, well, yeah, we don't care. It's just sitting out there. It's not encrypted. It's fine because it's not a breach of their compliance regulations. But it was just a clear security violation, but didn't affect them in any meaningful way because they didn't have to disclose it for HIPAA. And he got real bent out of shape kind of when we asked him about it because he says he has so much to deal with just to meet compliance that he doesn't care about the actual security underlying. He has too much on his plate already with these regulations. So it's interesting how much these two things sort of diverge. But as Mike said, again, there are things that security people care about that are not necessarily all that important. But I think that the two groups, there should be much more overlap.
I pretty much just agree with everything you both have said. I mean, especially what Killian just said about companies really only caring about compliance. I mean, you know, I talk to people all the time in a security role, and we point out certain things, and if it comes up all the time, they'll say, "Oh, we're not a public company, so we don't care about that," or "We aren't under any compliance, so we don't care about that." Well, you should still care. Just because, you know, if you're storing any sensitive content, you know, and that's somehow insecure, you're not protecting your customers, it doesn't matter if you're not publicly traded. That's still a vulnerability and you should always care about it. But, you know, like you said, especially people who are maybe understaffed or overwhelmed or whatever, they got bigger things on their plate. It's and I think this has come up a few times on the show, but it's hard for certain organizations to really dedicate the resources that they should, either, you know, time or money or whatever, to take these things seriously. I think that's an unfortunate reality that I don't really see a good solution for.
And just to kind of point out too, the guy that I was talking to, like, it wasn't his fault, and he was a nice guy. He was, you know, working real hard. He was definitely overworked and overwhelmed. So it wasn't like this was his fault, but he wasn't being measured against it by the organization. And that was, I think, the root cause of it, is they were so focused on meeting that compliance that if it wasn't specifically in that very narrow purview, it wasn't something that he had the time or bandwidth or wherewithal to address, really, or even maybe the footing to take it up the ladder to somebody who could address it. A little bit of it comes down to egos. I think he was a little bit upset because, you know, this wasn't his problem, at least from a corporate standpoint, but it kind of got sprung on him a little bit.
My follow-up question then is, shouldn't HIPAA be good enough and have enough outlines and guidelines so that if you do end up becoming HIPAA compliant, then you're secure?
A lot of the regulations don't get into the nitty-gritty of things. And I think that's probably good, in that, you know, you can't go into the HIPAA regulations and it'll tell you which cipher suite to use for, you know, your TLS, SSL certs negotiation for your web app. Like, that's just too much detail. I mean, what it says is you should take, you know, reasonable precautions to secure this data in such and such a way. You should take reasonable, you know, precautions to make sure people can access this. I think a lot of this is lack of understanding on different people and different roles. And a lot of this comes down to my mind, something I've always heard, and this is mostly about video games, but I think it's for any software application. There's no software application on Earth that ships without bugs. There's always something wrong. There's always something that could be done better. There's always something that could be, you know, made more secure. It's like asking about a novel. Like, is any novel perfect, you know, to the writer? And, you know, no, because they could always do something different. But that's the expectation, is that these things are perfectly secure. And that's a really hard thing to shake. So that if you're the contractor who wrote an application and, you know, you didn't have enough time, there wasn't enough budget, so you did, you know, the best application you could for the constraints you were under, to then have it come around and say, like, oh, well, this is insecure, therefore, you know, the whole thing was bad. It's a learning process on multiple people's parts and multiple roles.
I mean, it's funny. I just did a HIPAA presentation yesterday about that, talking about the reasonableness of the controls. But I think that's kind of built in and inherent is that there should be some type of constant review process. And I think that was the intent for HIPAA, at least specifically, that, you know, the reasonable and appropriate means that as technology evolves and changes, there should be continuous examination of what is currently reasonable and appropriate as things change and as new vulnerabilities come out. And I don't think that always happens in a lot of cases. But again, there are constraints in time and effort and budget that can preclude some of these things, especially in software development, but it's not a static thing. And I think a lot of people want it to be.
Yeah, there's no security switch that you go like, oh, we're secure and we're insecure, and you flip it and then everything's perfect forever.
I want that. Any last thoughts before we close out?
It's good to talk to everyone again. We've been off a few weeks. This is fun.
Thanks to Mike Buffy, Killian Engler, Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again soon. Thanks.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.